Good day. Today is Tuesday, 27th January 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again, if you've liked this programme, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, without further ado, let's discuss the situation in the world, and let's again focus on the Ukrainian conflict, and let's deal with a recent decision of the European Union on the subject of gas imports from Russia. Now, over the last 5 years or so, since before the start of the special military operation, the European Union, relative to Russia, has made many extremely bad decisions, some decisions which, in my opinion, have massively damaged the fabric of European economic and social life. But no decision that they have made up to this time has been quite as bizarre as the decision that they have taken over the last 2 days. Now, this decision was made by the European Council, and it's received, by the way, minimal reporting in the British media or in much of the Anglophone media. I think it has been slightly more widely reported in the European media, but it has certainly not been given the sort of attention that it should. And as I said previously, I find it completely, entirely bizarre. Bizarre to the point, practically, of absurdity. As things stand, Europe is going through a cold spell. The situation with gas reserves in Europe, though not critical, was already fragile before the start of this cold spell. The cold spell has resulted in more heavy gas use over the last 2 weeks or so, depleting the reserves further. And reserves are lower at this time of year than they normally would be. I believe that they're in their worst condition for 5 years, since 2021 to be precise, when, as I very clearly remember, there was a gas price crisis in Europe. Gas prices surged because consumption of gas in the winter had been high, and because a very dry summer caused more use of gas over the course of the summer, and this too caused gas prices to surge. At this time, the European Union was importing most of it, the greater part, the largest single block of its gas, not the greater part actually, less than 50%, around 40% of its gas from Russia, and that came in the form of pipeline gas. But over the previous years, the European Union, as I remember, had changed its policy in terms of gas buying, where previously various European companies had agreed long-term gas contracts with Gazprom, Russia's gas export monopoly, and with the encouragement of the European Union, they had gradually transitioned to buying gas on the spot market, in other words, on the free market. And this was, as I remember previously, rationalised as a market, a pro-market decision, but at a time when there was a significant gas shortage, what it obviously did was that it caused gas prices to rise further, significantly further than they would have done had gas continued to be supplied in the same quantities to the European Union by Gazprom according to long-term contracts. Well, we are in something of a similar situation now, not identical, First of all, we're only in the winter. We don't know what the summer is going to be like. It may be that summer conditions this year are going to be very different than in 2021, and it could be that this may mean it could be that this will mean that Europe will not face at the end of the summer the same sort of gas supply crisis that it faced in 2021. The other thing, which of course has changed, is that the Europeans have shut down all of the pipelines that were previously supplying gas from Russia to Europe. I say the Europeans, the Poles shut down the Yamal pipeline, which provided a flow of gas from the Arctic. Germany in February 2022, after the start of the special military operation, suspended Nord Stream 2. They then changed their policies. They said that they would work towards ending imports of gas from Russia. This was going to be the new policy, and in order to perhaps help along with that change of policy, some say, Seymour Hirsch says it was the Americans, the European authorities themselves, the German prosecution authorities say it was the Ukrainians. Someone set a series of explosions which destroyed most of the Nord Stream pipelines. I understand that there is still a pipeline which managed to escape destruction as a result of these explosions, but it has never worked. And by now, I suspect that it is in a less than optimal condition. And of course, other pipelines continued to function, or at least in theory, continued to function. There was the Druzhba network of pipelines constructed by the Soviet Union, but they have been steadily scaled down. For some time, the European Union itself has ceased to import gas through this network of pipelines. Hungary continued to do so for a while, but roughly a year ago, the Ukrainians, through whose territory the Druzhba pipelines pass, well, the Ukrainians basically closed them down, preventing further pipeline transfers from Russia, gas transfers via the Druzhba pipelines from Russia. So we've had all of this, and now the European Union facing a deindustrialization crisis. At the time of the decisions about Nord Stream 2 in February 2022, when the Olaf Scholz government in Germany announced that they were going to suspend the opening of Nord Stream 2, at that time, Alex Cristoforo and I, in a program we did on the Duran, said that this would trigger a deindustrialization crisis in Germany. We were the first to say, just say. Anyway, since then, deindustrialization in Germany has happened at an even more rapid pace and at an even greater scale than Alex and I anticipated when we made that program. Anyway, in the midst of deindustrialization in Germany, deindustrialization in other European countries, including, by the way, in Britain, where factories also close, in face of very high energy costs in Europe, perhaps not high by comparison with the level energy costs reached in 2022, but the relevant metric here is comparing energy costs in Europe with energy costs in Europe's various competitors, the United States, China, the Asian states, and others, with the energy costs in Europe being significantly higher. In the midst of high energy costs, which have rendered much of European industry uncompetitive, thereby further exacerbating deindustrialization processes. And in the face of what is widely referred to in Britain, but I believe elsewhere in the European Union also, as a cost of living crisis by European consumers who have to pay also the higher energy costs. In the face of all of this, the European Union has now made a decision that there will be no further imports of natural gas from Russia through any vehicle, be it pipelines. The only pipeline that continues to supply natural gas to Europe from Russia is Turk Stream. No further imports of gas from Russia in the form of LNG. There will be fines imposed if such imports take place, and various economic actors, businesses, companies, countries that import gas will have to undertake further regulatory checks to ensure that the gas that they import into the Union, into the European Union, does not come from Russia. Now, obviously, given the enormous reduction in Russian gas exports to Europe as compared with what we saw in 2021, this is not going to have the dramatic impact that it once did. The European Union does, as it happens, still import a significant amount of gas from Russia, but it is a fraction, I believe less than a quarter, of what it did at the peak. And I believe that we have now moved from a situation where the European Union used to import around 40% of its gas from Russia to a position where it now imports around 10% of its gas from Russia, and it might even be less than that. So we've moved decisively away from the gas import-export trade with Russia, which underpinned trade relations between the European Union and Russia once upon a time, and which provided Europe with steady, stable supplies of relatively inexpensive gas, which made European industries, and especially German industries, competitive. But it is still an extraordinary decision to make in the conditions in which the European Union now is. Yes, the amount of gas volumes imported from Russia have significantly fallen. But by definition, the European Union, by rejecting gas by law, by regulation, by rejecting gas from the world's biggest gas export country that shares with the European Union, the European continent, that is its close neighbour, is now creating structural conditions for higher gas prices. Higher gas prices over and beyond the level that they have already achieved. Even if all of the gas can be replaced, it's going to have to come from more expensive sources. Most of it is going to come from the United States. The United States now is by far the biggest exporter of liquefied natural gas to the European Union. And as I understand it, it now provides Germany with 96% of its liquefied natural gas, which basically is far and away most of the gas that Germany is importing. This gas that comes from the United States is obviously much more expensive than the pipeline gas that used to be supplied by Russia. As I understand it, it is also more expensive, I believe significantly more expensive, than the LNG that Russia was also supplying. So the European Union, by rejecting cheaper gas from Russia, rejecting it entirely, is inevitably going to be thrown back to depending on more expensive gas from the United States, much more expensive than the pipeline gas the European Union used to receive, more expensive than the LNG from Russia that it still receives. And, well, that's only part of the problem, because, of course, there is a global market for gas. If gas is supplied around the world, but flows of gas around the world, whether via pipeline or perhaps mostly by LNG now, is restricted, or you're going to inevitably get a fragmented energy market. Inevitably so. If the Russians cannot sell their gas to Europe, they will sell their gas to Asian importers, China first and foremost, ultimately India too. We know that Power-Siberia 1, the major gas pipeline that the Russians built to China, is now fully working. The Russians and the Chinese have agreed on the building of Power-Siberia 2, and I understand that the work on that pipeline has now started. So the Russians will continue to supply gas, and they will supply it to China, and they will no doubt supply it to other Asian producers as well. They will also, of course, supplement the pipeline gas that they're exporting to China with LNG, which they will also supply to Asian consumers. I believe Japan and South Korea, for example, certainly Japan, that they apparently still import Russian LNG. And I suspect that they will continue to do so. Even if they don't, the Chinese market is big enough to absorb pretty much all the gas that Russia produces. And the Russians have plans to supply gas to others as well, to India eventually. And there is talk that if Power-Siberia 2 is built, then a southern spur can be built, presumably expanded across the Himalayas, exporting gas from Russia to India as well. That is obviously a project for the very long term. But there will be other markets in Asia that the Russians can also tap. Vietnam, who knows which others. Malaysia, the King of Malaysia, is of course currently in, or has visited, Russia. Putin took him on a tour of the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Just saying, though Malaysia used to be a significant energy producer itself, I don't know whether it still is. But anyway, so the Russians are going to be able to export their gas, but they won't be able to export it to Europe. So Russian gas will flow east, but it cannot flow west. So given that this is so, given that Asian producers can, if they choose, still import gas from other sources, from the United States, from Qatar, from wherever, the Russians, though far and away the biggest producers, will be able to sell, will be competing, in the Asian markets, potentially, against other gas producers, but they will not be able to export to Europe. Europe, by contrast, can import gas from other expensive producers, most specifically the United States, but it cannot import gas from the cheapest producer, which is Russia. So what is going to happen? Well, it's not difficult to guess. In such a situation, we now have a structural imbalance, a fragmentation, a division in the global gas market. Gas prices will be lower in Asia than they will be in Europe. And that is now not just for the long term, but probably permanently so. So this all seems to me an incredibly illogical decision. The European Union has now made a decision which permanently locks European industry into energy uncompetitiveness. I cannot, for the life of me, understand how European leaders, if they were really concerned about the economic health of the European Union, could make such a bizarre decision as this. But that is what they have done. And, well, it confirms further that the European Union has now evolved into a geopolitical, ideological enterprise, that its major priority and the priority of the dominant member states that make it up, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, is conflict with Russia, and that they are prepared to sacrifice their long-term economic future to that objective. The Russians have shown that they can adapt to these prolonged economic wars. The Europeans, not so much, but the Europeans, nonetheless, continue. Moreover, there are other aspects to this. Just a few days ago, we had a major crisis between Europe and the United States. And I pointed out that if things ever deteriorated to the point of an all-out economic war between Europe and the United States, which, by the way, some were talking about at the time, the United States had critical advantages. The Europeans could sell treasury bonds, but doing that would have undermined the stability of their own financial system because they're so integrated into the American financial system. And I felt that that was something that they were extremely unlikely to do, if only because ultimately they do not want a long-term rupture with the United States, which mass selling of treasuries in a way that might have caused injury to the United States would have done. The Europeans could put up tariffs on American imports from the United States. But which imports precisely? Because there is a trade imbalance in finished goods from the United States in favor of Europe. The Americans import more finished goods, cars, machinery, that sort of thing from Europe than they export to Europe. Imports, tariffs on imports from the United States applied consistently would, of course, presumably have affected imports of liquefied natural gas from the United States, which would have raised prices of liquefied natural gas if from the United States, which Europe is depending upon, further exacerbating Europe's lack of competitiveness and its cost of living crisis. Perhaps the Europeans would have discussed a carve-out for natural gas. Who's to say? But one way or the other, tariffs doesn't look like a good idea to me. The United States, by contrast, has critical advantages. The point I didn't make last week, because I'm not a very tech-minded person, but it was pointed out by so many people that the United States has a monopoly on cloud computing, and they could have turned that off for Europe pretty much at the pressing, with this pressing of a switch. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration, but they could in theory do it. And as I pointed out in various programmes that I made last week, given the extent of European dependence now on imports of liquefied natural gas from the United States, the Americans are also in a position, were already in a strong position last week, to put pressure on the Europeans by stopping flows of liquefied natural gas to Europe. Now, there's a lot of people who push back on this. There were points that this would have taken time to have an impact. It would not have done, by the way. It would have had an immediate impact. It would have created a profound crisis in Europe if it had continued for even a week, if it had continued longer. Well, I can't even begin to imagine what the effect would have been. Given the extent now of European energy dependence and the even greater psychological dependence on liquefied natural gas imports from the United States. There were points about legal issues that the American gas companies have contracts and they might insist on fulfilling these contracts. But I pointed out, well, I repeat my own belief that the United States government would have had no difficulty making sure that the companies applied with whatever ban on exports of gas to Europe, on whatever grounds that the US government imposed. And, well, as for the cost situation, the fact that some of these gas companies are in a precarious position, well, all I will say about that is that the United States never hesitates to subsidise companies that it sees as strategically important, and I have no doubt that they would have provided subsidies to their gas industry also. So the Americans, in my opinion, absolutely have this power, and Donald Trump certainly is the kind of person who, if he is in the right mood, might do it. So anyway, that was the situation last week. That was what people were talking about. They were talking about an economic war. An economic war, in the end, didn't happen because Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, cut a deal with Trump, which, by the way, has not yet been implemented, and we'll see whether it ever is. But he cut a deal with Trump, which Trump, at that moment, was satisfied to walk away with. I've discussed that sordid deal in previous programmes, and we've done a whole programme about it on the Duran. But given what happened last week, it would be unwise to assume that such a situation might never arise again. Over Greenland, it quite plausibly might do. And anyway, it's unwise to be over dependent on a single supplier. But the European Union has thrown all of those concerns, all of those worries to the wind. They've gone ahead and they've done what they have done, and they are basically committed to it. They've done something else as well, which is very disturbing, but for which, of course, a precedent now exists. Late last year, when the European Union was still sniffing around the possibility of misappropriating the Russian assets frozen in Euroclear in order to use those assets as security for a loan to Ukraine they were talking about. Anyway, the European Union, in order to ensure that those assets would never be paid to the Russians, thereby undermining the whole concept of the loan, rammed through the European Council a decision whereby the freezing of these assets has now been made indefinite. Previously, the freeze had to be approved every 6 months. Now, the only way the freeze can be lifted is if every member of the European Council agrees. And of course, that means getting countries like Estonia to agree, which is not likely to happen in any foreseeable future. So the European Union took this extraordinary decision. It took this extraordinary decision in the face of strong opposition from Hungary and, I believe, a number of other EU states, notably Slovakia, which is now increasingly aligned with Hungary on these matters. Now, in order to avoid a situation where the Hungarians could veto what would have been a radical extension of the sanctions regime in the European Council, and the Hungarians do have a right to veto sanctions, the European Union instead invoked emergency powers created to deal with emergencies. Instead, it said that the unfreezing of the Russian assets might cause a crisis in the European financial system, and using those emergency powers, it imposed this indefinite freeze, not through unanimity in the European Council, as would have been required if it had been treated as a sanction, but by majority vote. Now, this was something that several EU officials were very unhappy about. At the time, I discussed how there were several European officials who spoke to the Financial Times, and one of them said that the reinterpretation of the EU's emergency powers in order to do this thing was insane. And several others said that it was contrary to the laws of the European Union, that what the European Union did was contrary to European laws, to the famous ACQUI, the body of laws that the European Union has itself created and upon which it functions. Well, this latest decision, which is in some ways even more bizarre and certainly more damaging than the one about freezing indefinitely the Russian assets, has been done in the same way. Because those assets were initially frozen as a result of sanctions that were imposed. The restrictions on imports of Russian gas into the European Union were initially imposed as a result of sanctions. Sanctions, further sanctions, require unanimity in the European Council. Hungary is dependent on gas it receives from Russia. The gas can no longer reach Hungary across the Druzhba pipelines because the Ukrainians have closed the Druzhba pipelines. But the Hungarians still receive gas through the European pipeline network, which originates from Russia. The gas comes to Hungary from gas exported by the Turk Stream through the Turk Stream pipeline by Russia to Turkey, and then Turkey re-exports it through the European pipeline network to countries like Slovakia and Hungary. As a result of the decision that has just been made, from 2026, I understand, the end of this year, that has to stop. From 2027, LNG supplies from Russia must also stop. So Hungary can no longer receive gas by pipeline from Russia, despite the fact that the Hungarian government, and by the way, the Slovak government, say that receiving gas in this way is vital for the economic health and future of these two countries. Now, the Hungarians and the Slovaks supported the sanctions against imports of Russian gas, the sanctions that were imposed previously in February 2022 and thereafter, all of the sanctions on Russia that have been imposed up to now on the basis of carve-outs that they themselves would not be bound by these sanctions. They could continue to import gas from Russia in the normal way because doing so was vital for their economic future. And had they not been granted these carve-outs, they might have voted down. In fact, they said that they would have voted down the sanctions packages which prohibited previously the restricted previously the import of gas from Russia into the European Union. So what the Hungarians and the Slovaks have now found is that those carve-outs are worthless, because repeating the pattern of what happened with the European Union using emergency powers in order to freeze indefinitely the Russian assets in Euroclear, the European Union has now blocked all imports of Russian gas into its territory. But in order to get round the Hungarian veto and the Slovak veto, it has said that it is doing it as part of its trade policy. It has changed the entire basis, legal basis, or is purported to change the entire legal basis of what it has done. It says it's no longer sanctions, it's trade. And trade decisions only require a majority vote in the European Council. Now, the Hungarians and the Slovaks are strongly objecting to this. And both Hungary and Slovakia are saying that they're going to bring legal proceedings, legal cases against this decision, presumably to the European Court of Justice. And on the face of it, they have an exceptionally strong case. I mean, changing the entire legal basis of something that you are doing from one thing to another in order to suit you, I mean, is already dubious, to put it mildly. Doing that in order to deprive someone else of their legal right, in this case Hungary and Slovakia, of their right to veto sanctions decisions, seems to me absolutely wrong and completely extraordinary. Doing that in order to, in effect, rescind carve-outs that Hungary and Slovakia negotiated in order to persuade them to agree not to exercise their right of veto in relation to earlier sanctions. Well, I have to say that from a legal perspective, I don't find that just wrong and extraordinary. I find it utterly wrong and completely extraordinary. And I could use much, much stronger language. The problem is that the European Court of Justice tends to be very deferential to the European Commission on these matters, despite the fact that on every legal principle that I am familiar with, I would have thought that the Hungarians and the Slovaks have an open and shut case. Given the political realities, I wouldn't be sure that the European Court of Justice would side with them. There is, of course, the further factor that the Europeans, the European authorities, and perhaps the European Court of Justice might quite easily, and indeed very probably, slow walk the entire case and decision. It might be because of the strength of the case that the Hungarians and the Slovaks win, but that they win in 10 years' time. By then, of course, the current governments in Hungary and Slovakia will have long since gone, and it may very well be that their successors are not interested in pursuing this case anyway. So I personally don't place much weight on this legal case. I would like to be proved wrong, but then who knows? I doubt that I will be. What I will say, though, is this, and I made exactly the same point when discussing the freezing, the indefinite freezing of the Russian assets using emergency powers. The decision that the Financial Times told us some European official was calling insane. Well, the European Union is a pure construct of law. It is entirely the product of treaties ratified by parliaments and of the various legislative acts that have been produced by, in many cases, the European Union itself. The European Union has no existence outside law. If all the laws and the constitution in Germany tomorrow were rescinded, well, there would still be a country called Germany. But if all the laws and treaties that make up the European Union were rescinded, there would be no European Union, at least not in any sense that we can imagine. In fact, there would be a legal nullity, and it would have to be recreated painstakingly all over again. Given that this is so, given that the European Union is itself a creature of treaty and law, a pure creature of treaty and law, that it only exists because of the treaties and the laws that created it, it does seem to me extremely dangerous, dangerous to the point of utter recklessness, for the European Union to be playing fast and loose with European laws and treaty laws and treaty rights, like the right of veto, in this way. Obviously, as many will say, we are in a situation where the European Union is becoming increasingly arbitrary. Perhaps some would say even lawless. But is this, in the long term, a sustainable position for it to be in, given what it is? Well, anyway, we shall see. The decision has now been made. The Hungarians and the Slovaks are upset and angry. They're talking about bringing these legal cases. The legal cases, as I said, to me look strong. I'm far from confident that they will be successful, however strong they are. We will see what happens. But think again about the obsessive quality that this whole episode again reveals. You've had a major row with the United States, which is your major energy supplier now, your key energy supplier now. You've been talking about an economic war with the United States. The United States has made threats, or at least the President of the United States and his officials have made threats to take over, acquire, annex the territory of a member of the European Union. And you do all of this, you take this decision, in spite of all of that, you increase your dependence on the Americans, you play fast and loose with your own regulations and laws, you create a structural situation of your future uncompetitiveness in order to achieve what exactly? Because, of course, the Russians, if they've survived the previous massive reduction in their export, their gas export trade to the European Union, are certainly going to survive this further measure. They have, as I said previously, a stable alternative market in China, which the European Union is not going to challenge. I would point out that European leaders are now queuing up to travel to Beijing. The British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is on his way this week. He's going to be soon followed by Friedrich Merz, and President Macron, France, was also in China a short while ago. So they're all going to China again. Doesn't seem to me as if there's any intention of getting into any kind of economic battle with the Chinese, which would be an even greater act of folly than the one I've just been talking about, by the way. But anyway, so the Russians have a stable market in China. Before long, they might have a stable market in India as well. The Americans have talked about, have complained about the fact that the Europeans haven't so far shown any willingness to impose massive tariffs on India and China, notwithstanding the fact that those two countries import Russian oil. Last year, the Trump administration said that it could not impose the 500% tariffs on India and China that Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal want the United States to impose, because the US is being undercut because the European Union won't impose tariffs on India and China on that scale as well. The Chinese are not going to be tariffed by the European Union, because, as we see, all the European leaders are trooping to Beijing, which is becoming increasingly strong in economic and trade terms. And the European Union has just agreed a free trade agreement with India, which they're hailing as a great breakthrough, the mother of all trade deals and all of that, but which, of course, would contradict decisions, the existence of which would contradict any decision to impose sky-high tariffs on India because it imports Russian oil, or in future, Russian gas. So the Russians have secure markets. They've adjusted to this situation. They're going to adjust again. Obviously, it's annoying to them that they've lost the European market. It's a big, highly profitable market, but they can live with it. They've shown over the last 4 years that they can grow their economy despite denial of access to the European market. The Europeans, by contrast, have been going through difficult economic times. Germany has been in has witnessed continuous economic contraction, or at least certainly industrial contraction, since 2021. They've taken a decision that is going to make that even worse. And they've played fast and loose with their rules in order to do it. You only do these self-destructive, self-defeating things when you are in the grip of an obsession. And it's quite clear to me that the European leaders collectively are. They continue to be single-mindedly focused on the conflict in Ukraine, on Russia, on President Putin, basically to the exclusion of all else. The Americans might be increasingly difficult and aggressive towards them and disrespectful of them, as they showed in Davos. The Russians might be absorbing all the blows. The situation in Ukraine might be going from bad to worse. The situation in the European economies might be going from bad to worse. But you just go on doing the same thing over and over and over again. However much self-harm it causes you, because as you are in the grip of an obsession, you cannot do anything else. I have to say, obsession at this level, the level of statesmanship, stuns me. I have never seen anything quite like it in my lifetime. Well, there it is. It is remarkable that things go so far. But look also at the way in which European leaders have been commenting about this decision. Look at the comments made by Prime Minister Frederiksen of Denmark, hailing this decision, even as her party loses ground in Danish elections, even as she's just had to navigate a difficult crisis with the United States and Denmark, over Greenland rather, which is far from resolved. She nonetheless hails this decision. Conflict with Russia, talk of war with Russia, insistence on unending support for Ukraine. It remains for the European leaders their comfort zone. They're far more happy, they're far more content talking about it than they are about anything else. Even when Zelensky comes along, as he did to Davos, and says shockingly rude things about them, calls them weak, and contrasts their weakness with the strength of the Americans and indeed of the Russians. What do the Europeans do? They stand up and they give him a standing ovation. As I said, a couple of European leaders have made known their displeasure at some of the things that Zelensky said. Matteo Salvini in Italy, senior official in the Italian government, but rival of Giorgia Meloni, the Prime Minister. He's been rather more critical of Zelensky and his comments than some. But if you actually compare what Zelensky said to the response of the European leadership to it, well, you could see that they're not in any kind of mood, have no desire at all to quarrel with him. So there it is. The Europeans prepared to go on doing this. There is, it seems to me, no limit to the self-harm that these leaders are prepared to do. It's not going to change Russian policy. It's not going to change the direction of travel of the war. It's not going to impress the Americans, though the Americans will no doubt be very happy to make more money by LNG exports to Europe. Most of the rest of the world must look upon this with amazement. But in Europe itself, in Britain, by the way, too, even though we're not part of the European Union, we carry on. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say about this really bizarre truly astonishing, in my opinion, incredible decision. If I wasn't a European, if I didn't live in Europe, and of course Britain is part of Europe, and by nationality I am Greek, and that is absolutely a part of Europe, I would perhaps even be amused by it. As a European, I cannot be. On the contrary, I am deeply upset by it when I think of what will come. But there it is. Our leaders, the leaders of Europe, have so decided, and so it must be. Well, even as all of this is going on, the war itself in Ukraine continues, and the Russians have been conducting more drone attacks. They have not, for some days now, not since the latest big missile strike on Kiev, conducted any further big missile strikes. Though everybody expects that they will come. There were reports of Russian surveillance drones over Kiev a couple of days ago. Probably they're still operating over Kiev, assessing the situation there and perhaps providing data that the Russians are going to use in their next strike, just to say. But the Russians have continued their drone attacks using the many different types of Garand drones that they now have. And they conducted strikes apparently on Kharkiv, particularly over the course of the last night. From what I can tell, Kharkiv has very limited functioning air defences. I'm sure there's heavy caliber machine guns still working, which can be used against drones. Though it's becoming increasingly difficult because of the way in which some of these drones now conduct diving attacks. But anyway, let's not get into the detail. But anyway, Kharkiv was particularly badly hit. So was Odessa, by the way. And in Kiev itself, the situation continues to be very bad. There are people in tents. The authorities are doing what they can to relieve a terrible situation, but there's certainly no sign of any mass evacuation or anything of that kind, as people expect more strikes to come in soon. And well, there are reports now, including one in the Polish media, which also cast doubt, from what I could see, about Ukrainian claims of success in shooting down hypersonic missiles. And I don't read Polish, but this particular article, as I understand it, discussed the recent attacks by the Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missiles launched from Crimea. And it said that these missiles move at such high speeds that the strikes that these missiles conduct take place roughly at the same time as the warnings, giving no time for the air defences to prepare. That seems pretty astonishing, by the way, but it could be true. I don't myself see any reason to doubt it. And, well, over and above and beyond all of that, there have been further reports of about a critically low situation in Ukraine's air defence system. I noticed that the German Defence Minister Boris Pistorius said that Germany has now absolutely reached the limits on what it can do in terms of supplying Ukraine with further air defence missiles. It's already provided Ukraine with a third of its air defence systems. There are no more Patriot missile interceptors to spare. And Germany has also provided Ukraine with a disproportionate number of the Iris-Ts, of which, as Pistorius correctly pointed out, Germany is the only manufacturer. So the Germans are saying that they've done all they can. And for Pistorius to say that, that strongly suggests to me that the Ukrainians have been asking the Germans for more help, probably because, despite claims that Zelensky made a short time ago, that Ukraine currently is not short of Patriot missiles. The actual reality is that it is, and that the shortage is getting worse. Certainly, in the attacks that I have seen, one does occasionally see Patriot missile interceptors being launched on the ground, trying to intercept incoming Russian missiles. But the number of cases of that does appear to be significantly reduced from what one saw, well, just a few months ago, in fact. So, Ukrainian air defences now very ragged. The Russians said that the air defence system in Ukraine is a Frankenstein. It's made up of many different incompatible systems, and it is breaking down. And the situation with energy remains very, very bad, perhaps incrementally getting worse. In the meantime, the Russians have provided further updates about the military situation on the battlefronts. And these came mostly from the overall Russian commander, General Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, who attended a meeting of a group of forces west, and who gave a long overview of the situation of the battlefronts whilst he was there. And by the way, there's also a video of his speaking. And he said some interesting things. He said, first of all, that since the beginning of January, the Russians have captured 500 square kilometres of Ukrainian territory. I'm not in any position to say whether that is right or wrong. But then he said something else, which has created quite a stir. He said that in the Kupiansk area, the Russians have just captured the village of Kupiansk-Kislovoy. This is a village to the south of the city of Kupiansk. And he also said that the Ukrainian force, which has been encircled on the east bank of the Oskol River, is now in the last stages of collapse, and that the numbers of Ukrainian troops still making up this force has now declined to around 800. When Putin and Gerasimov spoke about the encirclement of Ukrainian troops in this area east of the Oskol River, I think it was back in October or November, Putin's press spokesman, Peskov, said that up to 5,000 Ukrainian troops had been encircled. Well, that was some months ago. Then, about a month ago, we were told that the number had fallen to 2,500. Now, Gerasimov said it's just 800. And Gerasimov also says, as I said, that this village of Kupiansk-Kislovoy is now under Russian control. Now, this village is, or would be, the capstone on the arch of a Russian victory in the Kupiansk sector. If the Russians really do control Kupiansk-Kislovoy, as Gerasimov says, then it seems to me that the prospect of a Ukrainian relief force crossing the Oskol River to liberate the remaining men who've been surrounded, well, that has gone, and the chances of those men escaping across the river has probably gone also. If the Russians also control this particular village, then realistically, it seems to me, they are almost certainly also in control of Kupiansk itself, as they say. If you look at the map and you look how all of these places link up with each other, I find it very difficult to believe that the Russians can control Kislovoy, but not Kupiansk itself. And that probably explains why many, many people, Ukrainian, non-Ukrainian, Western in some cases, and even some people on the Russian side, some of the bloggers and people like that, have difficulty believing what Gerasimov has been saying. These are people who, over the last 2 or 3 months, have become very invested indeed in their belief that Ukraine has conducted some sort of successful counteroffensive in Kupiansk. And what, of course, Gerasimov is saying, that this village has now passed under Russian control, diametrically contradicts that picture. Now, I'm going to say a few things here, and that is that it's important to understand a very simple fact about this war. Most of us who are commentators, pretty much all of us who are commentators, are not there on the ground. We are not able to tour the front lines. We don't see what takes place with our own eyes in any particular place. Sometimes we can obtain drone footage or see drone footage and draw our own conclusions. Other times, most of the other times, we have to base our reports, or at least our assessments, on what the Russians and the Ukrainians tell us. To say it simply, it is the Russian and Ukrainian armies who are there on the ground, and it is they who mostly control the flow of information we receive. So what has been happening over the last few months is that the Ukrainians have been claiming a successful counteroffensive in Kupiansk, and the Russians have consistently denied it. They have said that this counteroffensive is mostly imaginary, that there has never been any moment when the Ukrainians have recaptured Kupiansk or any significant part of it, that the Russians remain firmly in control, and that it is they, not the Ukrainians, who are advancing in this area and who are tightening their grip on this Ukrainian force on the east bank of the Oskol River, and who have been capturing villages like Polody and now Kupiansk, Kislovoy. Now, to repeat again, I am not there. I am not in Kupiansk. I've not toured the city. I've not spoken to anybody who is there. What I would say is this. If you do not assume that what the Ukrainians say is true, if you listen to both sides, then Gerasimov's claim that Kupiansk Kislovoy has now been captured by the Russians is entirely consistent with the whole flow of information from the Russian side that we have been getting over the last 2 months. If the Russians have been telling us the truth about all of the other things, about the capture of places like Polody and other places, about the fact that the Ukrainians have failed to break into Kupiansk, that any footage of the Ukrainians there shows only momentary break-ins, which cannot be consolidated. Well, if that is the reality, if the reality up to now corresponds with what Gerasimov has just said about Kupiansk Kislovoy, well, then his announcement that this particular village has passed under Russian control becomes altogether unsurprising. It is a logical development of the situation on the ground in this sector. Now, to repeat again, I am not there. People are already demanding that the Russians produce footage showing their soldiers raising their flags in this village. Well, the Russians do often do that, and I've no doubt that it is useful, but it's perhaps worth remembering too that the Russian army isn't there to raise flags, it's to win battles, and raising flags in order to convince bloggers in the West perhaps is not fully consistent with its job. We will see. One thing I have absolutely no doubt, at some point over the next few weeks, Kupiansk is going to be under full Russian control. I suspect this has been true from the moment that the Russians announced its capture, but to repeat again, I am not there. Even if the Ukrainians have, however, conducted counterattacks in this area, even if they have recaptured positions in Kupiansk, these operations will be ephemeral, and at some point over the next couple of weeks, it will no longer be open to doubt that the Russians are in control of the town. Now, that's all I can say. As I said, it doesn't confirm what Gerasimov is saying. I still find it difficult to imagine that the Chief of General Staff and overall military commander would set out to deceive everybody about the situation in Kupiansk. I'm not sure why he would do that, by the way. I mean, what would he gain in doing that? I can see what he would lose in the enormous damage done to his credibility. But anyway, we will see. One way or another, the situation in Kupiansk will be resolved, and it will definitely be resolved eventually in Russian favour. Now, there have been other reports about the situation on the battlefronts. There's been a narrative that's been floating around over the last couple of days that the situation has, as I said, slowed down in the war, and there may be have some partial truth about it. But it's important to say that even if there has been a slowdown, I haven't myself seen a dramatic slowdown. It's probably the result of difficult weather and the Russians reorganizing and sorting out their logistics after the big advances they made in December, more than anything else. But anyway, over the last two days or so, the last 24 hours especially, it looks as if the situation on the front lines has indeed started to change and to shift, with the Russians clearly advancing again. Now, perhaps the first place to start is with the Zaporozhye sector. There were reports yesterday that the Russians have entered a small town called Zaliznichne, which lies to the west of Gulyapolye. Zaliznichne and Stara Ukrainka, which is another village to the north, represent the remaining fortified line, the next fortified line that the Ukrainians have hurriedly created to the west of Gulyapolye since the fall of that town and the Russian crossing of the Gaichur River. If Zaliznichne has indeed is indeed being stormed, and if, or perhaps when it falls, it will certainly be an important event in the ongoing advance of the Russians from the east westwards towards first Orekhov and ultimately the city of Zaporozhye itself. And I ought to say, on the topic of Zaliznichne, and another village a little further to the north called Ternovata, which the Russians are also in the process of surrounding. That these two villages are absolutely now on my map, my large-scale map of the city of Zaporozhye. The Russians are moving closer to Zaporozhye from the west. They still have many kilometers to go. They're still 30 kilometers from the west before they reach Orekhov itself, though the distance is shrinking. But anyway, the Russians indeed are advancing. And if you look at Orekhov, if Zaliznichne and Ternovata and all of these other places fall, then of course, when they fall, that will put the Russians closer, much closer, to one of the two big supply roads to Orekhov, one that reaches Orekhov from the northeast. And, well, on the other side, on the western side of the Zaporozhye front, the side where General Tuplinsky's group of forces, Dnieper, operates, well, there the Russians are advancing as well. And the reports claim, the Russian reports claim today, Gerasimov claimed today, that General Tuplinsky's troops have captured a village called Novoyakovlivka, which is located to the northwest of Orekhov. And it is not so far from the other main supply road that leads to Orekhov, this time from the northwest. And the Russians are now probably already within drone distance of that road. There's a cluster of villages that the Russians need to capture before they advance to the road. I think that they control all of them now, apart from one village, which is called Magdalinivka. But anyway, they are fairly close to that point now, or so it seems, and they can push eastwards. And there's two places, Yurkivka and Novopavlivka, close to Orekhov itself. And when the Russians reach them, they cut what I suspect is the bigger of the two supply roads, the one that extends to the northwest, to the city of Zaporozhye itself. And by the way, Gerasimov also said that the Russians are about 14 kilometres from the outskirts of Zaporozhye. He's again referring to General Tuplinsky's troops that are located south of the city. So this is significant news. Perhaps it's worth saying, comparing the pace of the Russian offensive in Zaporozhye region with Ukraine's offensive in this very same region in 2023. This was Ukraine's biggest offensive effort by far. The Europeans and the Americans provided huge amounts of equipment to enable the Ukrainians to break through from Orekhov to the siege of Azov to the Black Sea and to place Crimea in effect under siege. It was seen as the knockout blow that would defeat the Russians and which would pave the way for a Ukrainian victory. The American media has described how American generals took direct charge of the operation and were basically giving instructions to the overall Ukrainian Armed Forces commander, General Zaluzhny. A massive amount of time, energy and resources was invested in that offensive in 2023. And it completely failed. The Russians defeated it. The Ukrainians pushed south from Orekhov after prolonged battles. They claimed the capture of the small town of Robotino, but only after suffering extremely heavy losses. They captured a village called Pyatikhatki, which lies to the west, and they also captured a few villages to the east in the Vremevka Ledge, the area of the Vremevka Ledge or the Vremevka Salient. All of these places, Robotino, Pyatikhatki, and the villages on the Vremevka Salient, have been captured by the Russians. But the Russians have captured much, much more. They've captured all of the Vremevka Salient. They've captured the important town of Velikaya Novosilka. They've pushed west for Velikaya Novosilka. They've captured Guliapolye, a much bigger town than any of the places that the Ukrainians were able to capture during their 2023 offensive. Robotino and, as I said, Pyatikhatki are back under Russian control. The Russians control places to the north of Robotino, places like Novodanilovka and, as they claim, Malaya Tokmachka. They've also captured a string of these places to the northwest of Orekhov, one could, including Novoyakovlivka, which they claim to have captured today. They've pushed northward along the Dnieper, and they are, well, I think it's widely agreed, within perhaps 10 to 15 kilometers of the southern outskirts of the city of Zaporozhye itself. The Russians have conducted this offensive in a completely different way from the way the Ukrainians, with their American generals in charge of them, conducted their offensive in the summer of 2023. The Russians have been incremental and systematic and methodical. They obviously have an enormous preponderance of material, greater than that which the Ukrainians had in 2023. They have an air force, which the Ukrainians don't, or at least didn't, an offensive air force at that time. But that, to my mind, simply underlines the fundamental fact that in this war, the Russians are stronger, the Ukrainians are weaker. That is why, however incrementally and systematically and methodically the Russians go about things, their offensives gain territory and become increasingly effective, whilst Ukrainian offensives at best achieve only ephemeral results, or, as in the case of the 2023 summer offensive, fail completely. This is a reality that many people simply will not accept. Anyway, that's the situation in the war. There is one last thing I want to say, and that is that the Financial Times today and late yesterday confirmed my point about American security guarantees. Zelensky has been insistently demanding that the Americans give Ukraine security guarantees. He has said that this has already been agreed, that there is a document, and that all it needs is President Trump's signature. And he wants this document of security guarantees to be ratified as a treaty by the US Senate. I have said that the Americans have never been keen on giving Ukraine security guarantees. Joe Biden's administration, which was far more supportive of the Ukrainians than Trump's administration has been, never gave Ukraine security guarantees in that form, the form that Zelensky is currently demanding. And I thought it was a huge mistake, given the American stance, for the Americans to get into the business of discussing security guarantees for Ukraine, as they began to do in the weeks after the Anchorage summit in August between Putin and Trump. And I said that I expected that sooner or later the Americans would walk back on whatever promises they've made to the Ukrainians about security guarantees. And according to the Financial Times, that is basically what they have now done. They have told the Ukrainians that Ukraine is not getting any security guarantees from the United States unless Ukraine withdraws from Donbass. There is a final peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia, which can only be negotiated after Ukraine withdraws from Donbass, and any security guarantees given to Ukraine by the United States must be agreed as part of that peace settlement agreement, which means, in effect, that the security guarantees are going to have to be negotiated by the United States and Ukraine with Russia. It's the headline story in the Financial Times. It is exactly what I expected to happen, and it has. There is another article in the Financial Times, by the way, this time by Gideon Rackman. He gives a very, very different feel, a description of the state of the war from mine. He believes that the Ukrainians are holding their own, which I can't see at all. But even he admits that the negotiation process, which took place in the UAE, is only at its beginning. He says the Ukrainians only agreed to engage in it at all because they didn't want to annoy Donald Trump, and that the process could take years, which is exactly what I said, and which is exactly, in my opinion, what the Russians want. So anyway, there we go. Enlightenment provided, if you like, by the Financial Times. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. There are war drums beating in the Middle East. The United States has assembled large forces near Iran. The Iranians are worried about an attack upon their country. That is a topic that requires a lot of further discussion. I expect to turn to it in my next programme. But this is where I'm going to finish my programme for today. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.